Techtopia. Techtopia er en podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi. Den er udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med Teknologiens Mediehus, HI-messen, Index Award, Innovation Center Danmark og IDA Forsikring. Mit navn er Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Techtopia. Vi er elendigt forberedt på et cyberangreb, og når jeg siger vi, så mener jeg både private virksomheder og offentlige institutioner som hospitaler og infrastruktur. Det er ikke noget, som jeg selv har fundet på, nej, det kommer fra en snak, jeg har haft med en af IBM's ledende sikkerhedseksperter, nemlig den britiske Felicity March, der med udgangspunkt i WannaCry ransomware-angrebet, som larmede stort set hele det britiske sundhedsvæsen i 2017, råber vagt i gevær. De britiske computere, de var ikke opdateret, derfor så var de nemme ofre, men angrebet fik Felicity March til at anskue problemet med at modstå hackerangreb anderledes. Efter de mange store angreb i 2017, så er vi måske nok blevet bedre til at identificere angreb, og måske også til at stoppe dem. Men hvad når vi skal tilbage online igen, når vi skal rekonstruere alle vores data?
As we were looking at resilience and disaster recovery, business continuity and the traditional services that IBM offer, such as work area recovery, we had a separate, totally separate security organization looking after security. And over the last 3 years, IBM has experienced that when companies actually get hit with a cyber attack that is destructive or is encrypting, we found that the security team was not responsible for recovering back to normal operations. Because they're not. What they do is they protect the company from a virus. They detect it when the virus has got in or the malware has got in. And then their response is eradicate the virus, remove the virus, do the software hardening to stop it happening again and find patient zero and do the analysis and forensics. And we all live happily ever after, the end. But as a lot of people that are listening to your podcast know, restore from backup is not simple. And restore from backup is often incapable of working or it hasn't been structured in the right way. So I noticed that a lot of companies had this void between the CISO saying, I have found the virus and recover back to normal operations, which is sitting in IT ops and disaster recovery. So I was asked by IBM to do two things. I was asked to look at cyber resilience for the world and look at what cyber resilience is. And I was also part of a team of experts in IBM requested by Ginni Rometty to review some of our large accounts to look at their ability to recover. And when we started looking at companies and their ability to recover, we found some really, really nasty experiences. We found that although security were sitting in their own right of doing what they were doing, security were assuming that any time you needed to restore operations or recover from backup, it was not their job. But when you turned to the IT operations team, we were hearing that they said, oh no, we don't do that. We do traditional DR. We assume we're going to recover from a flooded data center, or we're going to move one application from a cloud to another application on the cloud. And what we then realized was that every single company had not invested in disaster recovery, business continuity, or business impact analysis. And it was the poor relative where security was getting a vast amount of the budget. So when we were actually simulating cyber attacks or destructive cyber attacks, and also looking at viruses such as NotPetya and WannaCry, we found that companies were being taken out to bare metal. So one company in the NotPetya attack lost 45,000 PCs, 4,000 servers in 27 minutes, wiped straight out to bare metal, including, just to add insult to injury, their phone system and their security gates in their company. Now, 3,000 companies were hit by NotPetya, 650 roughly put their hands up and said, yes, we've been hit, and the rest stayed very, very quiet. Now, there were huge losses with NotPetya. Absolutely vast losses. There were one company, FedEx, was 400 million TNT, 300 million Merck, 135 million in lost revenue, $175 million in additional cost, $870 million taken off their share price. So the US government has stated that NotPetya cost the globe $10 billion. WannaCry was the one that hit our NHS system in the UK. And that was because there were vulnerabilities sitting in the XP estate that weren't upgraded due to lack of budget. And 19,000 appointments were rescheduled. Now that raises a couple of interesting points. Yes, there's a financial impact. WannaCry has estimated somewhere between $4 and $8 billion of loss. And it wasn't because they were hit with a virus. It's because they couldn't recover back to normal operations. Because of their IT operations, assuming the CISOs was doing it, the security team were doing it, and the security team assuming the IT operations were doing it. So we found a couple of companies that restored after they were hit, only to be crashed again because they were backing up a copy of the virus. So people are not looking at the cyber attack as a new attack vector in IT operations. They are assuming that the whole security team have got it and they look after it. But the security team don't do that. And there's a debate in the industry whether or not the CISO is the person that should be recovering back to normal operations. And I can understand that debate, because although you have somebody that is very good at eradicating the virus, the skill set in knowing what IT operations need to be brought back up and how they need to be brought back up and what sequence, that's too much of a job for some one person to actually have. So I think it's very important that we then start looking, or what I found was important is when I said to companies, well, what do you need to recover first? They said, well, I don't know. Some said, oh, yes, so one retailer said, I definitely need my website up and running. It gives me £1 million profit a day. I said, great. What technology do you rely on for that website? And they said, oh, well, my app, of course. And I said, yes, but what does your app rely on, and other subsets, and other SaaS systems, and what data sets, and what databases, and what platforms, what servers, what network elements are you reliant on for that website? And he said, I don't know. I don't know, actually. I haven't thought about it.
Ifølge Felicity March, så er der ingen af de meget store virksomheder, som hun arbejder med, der er klar til at komme godt ud på den anden side af et hackerangreb, fordi de simpelthen ikke har den nødvendige backup eller systemerne til at foretage den. Derfor har hun og resten af IBM opfundet begrebet den minimale virksomhed. Den mindst mulige udgave af en organisation, som kan holde en forretning kørende selv efter, at alt er blevet slettet totalt. Desværre ser det ud som om, der er lang vej, før hendes arbejde for alvor bærer frugt, fordi virksomhederne er simpelthen ikke klar.
So IBM has created this concept called minimum viable company. And the minimum viable company is what is the bare bones that your company need to make sure you can maintain core purpose and integrity no matter what. So a hospital always should have access to patient records. A hospital at trust in Canada on 22nd of January this year was attacked with a zero day. They were leaking to the dark web, so their security team did exactly what their security team was designed to do. They detected it and they responded, and they responded to, we are leaking to the dark web, turn it off until we stop it leaking. Great idea. The human impact of that was, of course, surgeries were cancelled, A&E departments in 24 hospitals were shut, and children who were dying of terminal cancer were not given the treatment that they needed because they could not access patient records, hence they could not understand dosage, hence they did not treat the children. That is utterly unacceptable in today's world. So the concept that we are championing is, what is the areas or the skeleton service that you need to provide to make sure that you can maintain core purpose? So we were finding that when we were looking at what the business needs. So patient records, always have access to patient records. Retailer, I need my website. That one retailer said, I need my website back up and running in 5 minutes. That's a great thing. So he knows he needs it in 5 minutes. He said, I will be sacked at 15 minutes. And I said, but the mainframe you're reliant on has an eight hour SLA on it, and your database will take at least 12 hours to restore if it's clean, and you haven't got a big fat virus in there. So you're not coming back up in 5 minutes. The other thing we find is people do active-active. But when you go active-active, you're just spreading the love almost immediately across the whole environment.
You have to explain that. So active-active.
Well, when they set up their infrastructure when they actually pass data over, it's not active passive, so they actually basically spread, the data goes across almost immediately. So but when we are looking at those overall infrastructure systems, if I can take a step back, what we are finding is everybody is still stuck in technology towers. And what I mean by that is, in the early 90s, Gartner, and rightly so, towered us. Do you remember they put IT towers in? And we all said, this is excellent. So they have a data center tower, an infrastructure tower, an end user, a desktop, a network, a cloud, a security tower. And all of the people were aligned into service towers. So you have people talking about the databases, or people talking about their app, people talking about cloud, or their data center, or their infrastructure, or network, or end user. And you'll find that a lot of tech companies look at each of those areas. And outsourcing contracts, of course, had service schedules created for each of those elements of towers. But now we're finding that people are still stuck in those towers, so they can say, oh, my cloud is okay, my data center's okay, my server's okay, my end user's okay. But of course, with procurement in large companies, they've usually got multiple suppliers and multiple hybrid in-house services, public clouds, and legacy systems that they rely on. So it's all a nice mishmash of spaghetti in most companies where their IT is. And the problem with that is when we actually say, well, what are the critical parts of the business that need to keep functioning? And what is your risk that you and your business needs you to have? It is a million miles away from how they actually run the technology. So nobody we're finding in companies have the ability to actually understand what their core business is, what their core business is reliant on, and the business risk does not correlate to the IT risk that people are building their technology to.
So if you're a company, what should you do then? Should you keep a sort of analog, what would you call it, backups?
There's a three-pronged approach that companies should do. One, the CIO needs to go back to being a CIO, not discussing technology and what hard disks are within each server. I think the CIO, the COO, should understand what parts of the business are critical and what parts of the business need IT. I think, two, companies now need to really do some IT archaeology. It used to be IT architecture. Now we're finding a lot of companies don't even know what they've got or what SaaS solutions their business have got, or shadow IT. And once they understand what their business needs and when, I think when we start looking at the technology side of it, the CISO should make sure they actually even know the name of the DR manager. Plans and simulations should be run, assuming how you actually get a technology stack recovered properly so companies can recover. Backups need to be taken, forensically cleaned in a cleaning room, locked away in immutable storage, and given point-in-time copies so you can roll back very, very quickly. Disaster recovery plans should be for the whole technology stack or the business area, including multiple suppliers if necessary, rather than I've done my DR because I've moved one app from one server to another. And that disaster recovery should include the whole holistic part of the overall business. Real-time RPOs and RTOs, which are recovery point objective and recovery time objective, should be reported at the board, and in fact financial regulators are now starting to discuss the importance of resilience, and regulations are coming out showing that the resilience has to be a responsibility of the board. Measurements of resilience should be reported at the board. There should be ownership at the board, and even more importantly, the European Central Bank Oversight Committee is now saying that cyber resilience is a responsibility of everybody in the company. So I had one retailer who said to me, I have 66,000 employees that know exactly what to do if someone puts a kettle in their handbag and walks out the shop. I have 66,000 employees that have not a clue what to do if the till doesn't work because the IT's gone down. So we now need to look at, and this is where the regulations are coming, is the responsibility is the whole company to understand what they do and how they function without technology. So we have a couple of banks that I'm working with, and they are creating something called Skeleton Bank, or a minimum viable bank, which is making sure you and I can access our money. And this is why I think it's essential in this industry and my generation to ensure that if we have hospitals or energy companies or national critical infrastructure or services that have a human impact, we need to make sure that they are responsible ethically and morally, that their IT architecture is built to the standard to make sure that they can bounce back up. Now, the reason I get so passionate about this is if I was looking at IT architectures and saying, yeah, you're there or thereabouts, that's fine. They're trying very hard. What I'm finding is companies that say, oh, we haven't done a DR test in 3.5 years. My supplier does my disaster recovery for me. When I've looked in the contract, there is no contractual terms for the supplier to do it, and the supplier doesn't have a contract to do it either, and they've never run one. I've got some very big companies that that we all rely on that have not turned their servers off since 2015 because they're too frightened they won't reboot again. I've got one company where a lot of people, vulnerable people, are relying on these systems that are running on a 31-year-old VAX VMS with no resilience built in at all. One company said, oh, we did 4 disaster recovery plans last year. I said, excellent, that's brilliant. They said, yes, we cancelled each one, we weren't ready. Or people that say, oh yes, we've got a DR plan, so we've got to spend 8 weeks upgrading and repatching to make sure we're ready for the DR test. Or companies that say, I've done a DR test on 10 applications, so that works on the assumption that that will work for the next 2,000. And we're also finding that people are not doing their backups or looking at the quality of their backup to make sure that they're not just copying a version of the virus straight into the backup and mean they'll have to do a rebuild. One company, I had to tell them that I believe that if they went down, that they would go down for 4 weeks because they'd need to do a rebuild from scratch. And they said, no, we disagree with you. We think it's 7 weeks. And that they know that this will take them down, but they're not getting budget from the board because it's not a, cyber resilience is not a discussion, or is starting to be a discussion in the industry that people are starting to take very seriously. And including when we are looking at people that are rating, so Moody's, for example, is starting to look at the resilience of the company. But you would be amazed when you look at the financial reports of a lot of companies and say, look at their risk. What you've got to do is look at their risk section, and you find that 50% don't even talk about IT as a risk. But IT is not IT anymore. IT is your blood, is the flow of your blood through your company. IT is now your data flow. And when I say data flow, it's not a technology data flow to find out what data you're using on what app. What I mean is it's your lifeblood. Your data flow comes into your company. The faster you can flow it through your company, the more money you earn, the less cost you have, or the if it's a hospital or a national critical infrastructure, the more you can serve the people that you're serving. But what we're finding is, if I can use this analogy, is if you imagine there's a body on a hospital bed, you've got one doctor looking at the hand, another doctor looking at the foot, and another doctor looking at the head, and they're all saying, yeah, hand's still there, foot's still there, the head's still there, yes, I'm doing my job, it's all good. And someone says, but the patient's dead. And they go, oh, but my job was the hand, and my hand's still there, so I'm good, I've passed my SLA. And no one is saying, what is the core purpose of this company, and how do we make sure that company is continuing to function? And if that IT goes down, how do we make sure that company still functions? And it's that bad. It's that bad. I haven't found a company in 2018 or 2019 that I personally believe couldn't recover from a major technology outage or a cyber incident, which is really, really scary. We need to wake the world up, and I genuinely believe that we're walking into a perfect storm.
You used the term scary. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is kind of scary because it seems like the whole society is sort of, it could break down.
Yeah, well, let me give you one example. So the NHS in the UK was hit with WannaCry and they had to turn their systems off, and 19,000 people had their appointments rescheduled, roughly 3 to 6 months later. Now that's 19,000 vulnerable people. And what we found is, in fact, I know one person who's now dying of terminal cancer because they weren't diagnosed in time. So The NHS put their hands up and said, yep, we've got hacked. We're leaking to the dark web. But what they should have done is said, we didn't upgrade our XP machines. So we didn't upgrade when we had a vulnerability. So there was a miscorrelation between the person that was sort of sitting at the bottom needing to do the upgrade, and that message was not being sent up to the gods and the people that are running the NHS to say, we have a vulnerability, this is what can happen. Now, Henrik, if we were a train company and we ran trains and our train wheel fell off and there was a train crash and let's say a few people died, we would know who put that wheel on, who took that wheel off, how many miles that wheel had done, who was responsible, and there would be an investigation as to the deaths that that train crash caused. The human impact of outages, a good example being the NHS, 19,000 people, we can no longer stand up to that and say, I'm so sorry, we got hacked. You have to, I think, in this industry, there will be a culpability. There has to be of responsibility of what happens if IT systems go down. Or there has to be ownership if they haven't built their IT systems to a capability of being at least some kind of resilient. And that's what causes me distress at the moment. We've got companies that have a DR site that takes 6% capacity of the production environment, but there are no plans and they haven't done it. I've got companies that haven't done DR in 5 years. We've got companies that have boxes on the wall, but they've never opened them to see what happens. So we're not making sure that the world is resilient. So going back to the NHS, when does it become serious? When it's human impact? Because 19,000 people were impacted. I know one person who's now dying. But can you imagine how much suffering, extra suffering? Is that the hacker's fault? Is it the NHS for not upgrading their systems? Or is it just a fact of life? Or should it be in the future, making sure that people, if they are offering services to the public and giving service to the public, ensuring that they have that level of resilience to make sure that they can defend against this new attack vector?
You mentioned that this should be something that would be the responsibility should be on the board.
Yes.
It seems a bit like it's also an organizational problem within companies.
It is. I think it has to be. If we offer, I think, Henrik, if we had a company, any company, a retailer that provides food or a hospital, you cannot be the CFO until you've got your qualifications, proper qualifications, in a chartered accountant to be able to run the finance. Why on earth do we have people that have zero qualifications running IT and deciding, making decisions on how they back up, making decisions on how they run their IT? I would say 90% of the people that I have talked to are backing up, assuming that it's okay because they put it on tape and they go to Iron Mountain, or they put it on tape and they leave it in the data center, not even thinking that they need to forensically clean. So if we have another attack vector, just as we went through all our wars in the history, is everybody had different weapons and we had to defend against different weapons. First World War was mustard gas. Second World War was the atomic bomb. And we have to actually defend against these attack vectors. I think there's been a miscommunication in the IT industry where everybody assumes security is looking after cyber attacks, where actually the IT operations need to look at their ability to recover. And I'm finding that it's not just cyber attacks. Actually, a lot of IT companies are not investing in their ability to remain resilient. And there are no standards in the industry to say this is the level of resilience that we would expect. Now, I don't want to regulate the IT industry, Henrik, because we would slow down capability and invention and innovation. But you and I know that if we had a fire in this room today, we'd know what to do. We have to evacuate. And every year, someone would come and check the sprinkler system and the fire alarm system. I would love, by the time I retire in 12-something years, somewhere between 12 and 17 years, I would love there to have an ability that if you are providing public services, that you are having your resilience ability checked on a quarterly basis. Why on earth do companies that are providing critical services to you and me not have to do DR tests in 2, 3, 4 years, and DR tests that are designed and created by the person that's sitting there saying, oh, I'll just test to make sure one application works and assume the rest is okay. So it is an organizational issue. It's an industry issue, and hence why I'm spending a lot of time doing talking to people like your good self to say, we need to wake the world up. We need to really tell everybody that we've got a problem and it's going to hit us. And how do we need to change the architecture in very simple ways to make sure that you can scratch and burn from bare metal and continue to function?
Felicity March, hun går under øgenavnet Flick, og det har fulgt hende siden barndommen. Hendes hackerkarriere, den startede for alvor den dag, hendes far kom hjem med en computer, som han tog låget af.
Well, it started when I was 6 years old. My father came home from work with his computer, and in those days the computer was a keyboard at the front with a screen and a little tiny till receipt printer on the right-hand side. Now, I'm the third daughter, and he doesn't have any sons, so he decided that, being an engineer himself, that we should understand about computers. So he undid the four corner screws of the computer, and he lifted off the lid, and I saw my first motherboard. And I fell in love, absolutely fell in love. So the next day, while he was still sleeping in at the weekend, I got my screwdriver out, and I took off the four screws, and I looked at the motherboard, and wondered what those little chips did, so then pinged the first one off and pinged the second one off, and ended up taking all of them off to have a look at them, not realizing they were soldered on. So after that, when my father found it, it was the most expensive computer I've ever owned, because I had my pocket money docked for what felt like 500 years, but I think it was about 2 months. So it was very sensible and bought me a computer. A Commodore 16, not a 64, so I couldn't play games. I had to code it. And I was coding my computer to play Beethoven's Fifth by about age of 10.
And when is this?
This was 1970. Well, I started in 1977, so I'm 48 now. So, and then by the age of 12, somebody told me that computer programs have back doors, and you can find the back door. So it's a bit of a challenge to a 12-year-old. So I could actually access and go into programs and systems by sort of the age of 16, 17. And then I realized that there's some really nasty people out there with some very nasty photographs. So I had great pleasure in taking some of those people down and handing information over to the authorities.
But this is now the internet age, because I assume that you weren't on the internet when you started doing this.
I was not, no. But of course, you could then dial into various different systems through modems. But yes, but then the internet came out, and I went into actually running computer systems and services. So I left my hacking career behind and went into running very, very large IT systems.
But you started out hacking with modems and hacking bulletin board systems.
Mm, yes.
How did you do that?
Various different ways. And what you could do is people used to remember, people used to share their computers and actually their information. And when you went in, they would tell you what files you could download. So I started by hunting games down and extra levels of games. But once you were actually in that system, then you could find out what other files they had. So it's quite fun.
What kind of computer did you use?
I had an IBM PS2 386. It had 2 5.5-inch floppy disks at the front. And yes, I remember it very, very lovingly. In fact, the PS2, I remember there was a newspaper article at the time that said nobody needed a personal computer that fast. But yes, I was. I even bought an external 3.5-inch disk drive as well when that came out. And I remember when they had compression, so you could take your 1.44 megabyte disk to 2.88, which was all very exciting. So it's all very different now.
It's kind of nerdy for a girl.
It is kind of nerdy for a girl. At the time, I didn't think it was nerdy. I think in the 70s and 80s, there wasn't so much nerdiness around. I think it was all just an emerging thing. But I've always been a toy boy, so I race motorbikes, which I also got into as a child. And I just thought this was normal. So I found that I was a natural with it as well. So yes, I suppose I am a geek, but I think they call it a chic geek now. So that's what we like to think anyway.
Sophisticated geek.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, sophisticated geek. I think actually being a geek is cool. And I think, especially with girls today, there's a campaign out at the moment in England saying you can't be what you are, you can't see. So it's very important that young girls see different role models as to what you can be and achieve. I never wanted to fit in. I just wanted to follow my passions and my hobbies. And that was motorbikes and computers and gardening and animals. So it was just things that I like doing. I think it's quite nice that I had that level of independence rather than needing to follow the norm, I think. So,
given your interests and your career, do you have any advice for like parents or if they want to get their girls to be interested in natural sciences or technology?
I think there's a lot more pressure now these days on girls to fit to society norms. It distresses me a little bit because we find a lot of girls have self-esteem issues or especially with the emergence of huge amounts of social media pressure. So I think it's important for girls to follow their dreams. There are a lot of girls that I've met that do motorbiking, do biking, do computers, enjoy engineering. I just would like to see more pressure on social media and advertising campaigns to not try and fit into society norms. That there weren't adverts out there when I was a kid. There weren't any magazines in showing what the girls should wear or what color of their lipstick, or there certainly wasn't in my sphere. There was one magazine, I think, when I watched at 18 or read at 18, but that was full of pop stars and what the pop stars were doing. And I think we had a page of in the center of one poster of one of the pop groups that was we were interested in. So it was much easier in my day. I was also at boarding school, an all-girls boarding school, which you would think would make us all very, very girly. But I think being in a girl-only environment, it allowed us to be the women that we wanted to be. And the school I was in was a very sporty school, so we were gymnastics, hockey, netball, and funnily enough, no technology. We had no technology at all, which was quite hard, so I could only, from the age of 14 to 16, I could only play my computers when I went home. So that was quite interesting as well.
That must have been tough, on the weekends.
No, on holidays. I was gone for 12 weeks at a time.
And no computer.
And no computers. So I got very sporty, very, very sporty. And also finished my exam. So I just delved into physics, chemistry and maths were my passions and biology. So I just enjoyed reading and learning all about that instead. But I seem to consume information very, very fast.
Flick, hun er et forbillede i England, men herhjemme der bekymrer vi os også om, at der er for få kvinder i tech-branchen. Så hvordan får vi flere unge kvinder til at søge ind på datalogiuddannelser? Og hvordan øger vi diversiteten i tech-virksomheder? Ja, det er nogle af de spørgsmål, som jeg søger svar på i Techtopias søsterprogram på Radio 4, hvor en af gæsterne er Ph.D. i datalogi, Signe Sambak, der har skrevet bogen Kvinde, kend din kode, som skal inspirere flere kvinder til at søge ind i tech.
Ja, den handler jo om kvinder i kodning og også om at kode. Så den er sådan, man kan sige, lidt todelt, hvor den starter med noget historisk om, hvor mange kvindelige rollemodeller vi egentlig har inden for IT. Fordi der er utroligt, altså når man først går tilbage til 40'erne og 50'erne, så er der rigtig mange kvinder, som har arbejdet både med teknologi og med programmering. Så det er ligesom tyndet lidt ud siden, må man sige. Så den del skulle ligesom fungere som en motivation. Men jeg har også en rimelig stor del af bogen, som så handler om rent faktisk det at kode. Og der er også en lille selvhjælpsbog til at forstå hardware. Altså, hvad er det, der er i computeren, og hvad er det, man snakker om, når man snakker om RAM og harddisk og CPU og den slags.
Så du kommer vidt omkring på de her godt 100 sider.
Ja.
Der er sådan en masse, hvad skal man sige, eksempler på hvordan man kan programmere, programmeringseksempler. Hvad er det der for noget?
Jamen, det er jo simpelthen sådan nogle små, stille og rolige eksempler på, hvordan man kan lave en applikation. Og jeg har forsøgt, at det er nogle af de de ting, som man skal lave, det er nogen, som er lidt relevante. Altså, der er et par eksemplerne. Det er jo bare sådan, det handler simpelthen om Excel, altså at kunne lave et regneark, hvor man kan beregne nogle ting. Og det er jo faktisk i virkeligheden første trin på at lære at programmere, det er at lære at forstå et Excel-ark og kunne lægge tal sammen i et Excel-ark. Jamen, så er man allerede ved at være derhenne i den tankegang, som man skal bruge til at programmere. Og så har de eksempler, jeg er kommet med, det er så for eksempel, at man kan beregne klimabelastningen af sin mad. Selvfølgelig ud fra nogle data, som vi satser på, er korrekte. og den anden, det er også noget med at få prøve at beregne, hvad alt efter, hvor meget barsel man tager, hvor meget pension skal man så spare op. Det er så, kan man sige, meget kvindeting, fordi at der er rigtig mange kvinder, der ikke får sparet op, mens de er på barsel, og de tager jo, som vi snakkede om før, rigtig meget barsel. Og det betyder ret meget i sidste ende, og det kan man så sidde og regne på, hvor meget betyder det egentlig for mig, at jeg mister i forhold til min mand. Så det er sådan lidt sådan selvhjælpseksempler, men der er også nogle, når man så ligesom er kommet hen over Excel, så er det, så er der også noget med at prøve at lave nogle apps, fordi der er faktisk nogle udmærkede tools, som ikke bare er sjov for børn at arbejde med, men også for voksne, hvor man kan lave alt muligt. Man kan lave en skattejagts-app uden de helt store krumspring, og man kan også lave noget, hvor man sådan nogle mere brugbare apps. Jeg lavede sammen med ungerne i Coding Pirates, hvor jeg også er frivillig, som er sådan en organisation for børn, der skal lære at kode i både dreng og piger. Der lavede vi sådan nogle apps, sådan en Hent mig-app, hvor man ligesom laver en app, hvor man trykker på en knap, og så sender man sin adresse til sin mor eller far, og så kan de så komme og hente en der, hvor man er, ved hjælp af GPS'en. Det er sådan en ultra simpel app, enormt brugbar. Jeg synes selv, den var ret brugbar. Jeg har installeret den på min børns telefon. Så sådan nogle ting, som kommer tæt på, og som ikke er alt for svære til lige at starte med, sådan, så man ikke går i gang med at lave et eller andet stort og voldsomt projekt, men starter i det små.
Du kan møde Signe Sambach og administrerende direktør i IT-branchen, Natasha Friis Saksberg, i Techtopia Radio 4, og den kan du downloade fra radio4.dk/techtopia. Du har lyttet til Techtopia, der udkommer hver eneste mandag. Du kan finde flere episoder på techtopia.dk. Du kan skrive til mig på henrik@techtopia.dk. Du kan deltage i vores teknologidebat i vores Facebook-gruppe, der hedder Techtopia Backstage. Og så kan du følge med på Twitter på @techtopia.dk. På genhør i næste uge. Techtopia er en podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi. Den er udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med Teknologiens Mediehus, HI-messen, Index Award, Innovation Center Danmark og IDA Forsikring. Mit navn er Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Techtopia.